Hey, this is Cleveland Brown, and you're listening to the About Last Night podcast. I guess your TV must be broken. Haha, just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding. You're bored.
This weekend, I will be in West Jordan, Utah at Wise Guys Comedy Club, Friday and Saturday, June 21st and 22nd. Two shows each night. Come out and see me, baby. West Jordan. Is that West Michael Jordan? I don't know. Naming a city after one of the players that ripped up your Utah Jazz. That seems fucked up. But either way, I'm going to be at West Jordan, Utah, the Wise Guys Comedy Club, this Friday and Saturday. Tickets at AdamRayComedy.com. Brad Williams will be at the Stardome in Hoover, Alabama, Friday and Saturday. Tickets at BradWilliamsComedy.com. Today's episode of the About Last Night podcast is a good one. Holy shit. If you know anything about me and my favorite stand-up comics, Bill Burr, Dave Chappelle, Patton Oswalt, David Cross. But the guy for me, it's always been the guy for me, Greg Giraldo, who passed away unexpectedly and just horrifically in 2010. He was 44, and it was a big fucking bummer, man. He was one of the most brilliant comedic minds I think we've ever had. Smartest, too smart for his own good, some say. But his life should not be forgotten, and his comedy lives on, obviously, with YouTube and his albums. His last special he did, Midlife Vices, I highly recommend to go watch. Good Day to Cross a River, his last album he did at the Comedy Works in Denver, and he was just one of the best, dude, and everyone said the nicest. And I got to work with him one weekend in Irvine, which I talk about in today's episode with Maddie Bolliker, who wrote Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story, which is out right now on Amazon. I think they're going to get an Audible book together. Wherever you get books, Barnes & Noble, but Amazon's the hot spot. So get your copy of Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story, written by Maddie Bolliker, and who I've known for a while. Real funny comic, and took it upon himself to get this story out there and make sure that Greg's story and essence and comedy was not left in the past. So get this book wherever you get it, and follow Maddie on Twitter at MaddieBGame. Follow me at Adam Wright Comedy, at FunnyBrad, at ALN Podcast, AboutLastNightPodcast.com for past and present eps and all your ALN merch. Shop AdamRay.com for all my Adam Ray stuff. And Read the Room, of course, still available on Amazon, Google Play, Spotify. So go get my album, Read the Room. Enjoy it, because I'm touring with a new hour. So it's perfect. You listen to the album, you get all caught up, and then you get some new shit. If you came out to the M's game on Monday to see me throw out the first pitch, holy shit, what a dream come true. I didn't bounce it 50 Cent style or Mariah Carey style. Threw a strike, god damn it, and it was a blast. Got to go into the booth, talk to my boy Rick Riz. He talked about me on air, because if you haven't seen the video, which you should, on my Instagram at Adam Ray Comedy, I ripped off my jersey to reveal a Dave Niehaus jersey, which was our famous announcer from the get-go, 1977 to 2010. And that was a cool reveal, just to kind of do a little something special. You know, there were so many ideas I had. I wanted to bring Brad up and have him be at first base and lead off, and I would try to pick him off, and then he'd run around the bases, which would be hilarious, and then I would chase him down and try to tag him out at home plate. But I don't think the MLB would go for that. It would take too long. It wouldn't be a first pitch. I digress. It was a blast. Thanks for coming out. And thanks for listening to today's episode. So many great episodes on the way. Monday, Seth Green is on the About Last Night podcast. You don't want to miss that one. Make sure you subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you get your audio. And email us at aboutlastnightpod@gmail.com. Where you get the podcast, how you got into it, what you love about it. And we're going to be reading some fan emails in the next couple weeks, because we've got some big announcements coming up. I think that's it. Now that we got the tour dates, Twitter handles, and merch info out of the way, sit back, relax, and enjoy a very special episode of the About Last Night podcast with the writer of Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story, Maddie Bolliker.
Well, the weekend's over and it's time to chat about it.
It's time to chat about it.
Got a midget and a juice, so why don't you sit down? And
so why don't you sit down? And
listen to our dope podcast.
Yeah. Whether
lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of day. So
come over and treat yourself right. It's about last night. Come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night. Well, come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night. So come on and treat yourself right. It's about last night.
So you're going no cans?
Yeah, no cans.
Now, why is that? You don't like the sound of your own voice?
It's a little weird, yeah.
It is. But you're...
Do you like... I mean, because you're like a professional voice actor. Do you like the sound of your own voice?
I make at least 15 bucks a session. I don't mind it. When I first started having to like record sets, you know, I thought that it was just like really... Also, you're listening to yourself at the early stages of comedy when you don't have your, you know, total point of view yet. And so right. I felt like I was doing what I thought a comedian should sound like, you know. But also, and, you know, just a segue into why you're here, but like Greg Giraldo was and is one of my favorite comics ever. So you definitely start to feel like you emulate who you like. And not that I would try to do his voice, but his cadence, his timing, his like... I thought he was likable, but he had a little bit, his emotional connection to his material was what I really resonated with. And not that it was like, he never seemed angry to me. He just seemed like perturbed. You know?
That's a good point.
Yeah. But let's, so you wrote this book.
Yeah. Is this recording?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're going, baby. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought we were just
Matty Ballacher, who I've known for, I mean, dude, probably since I started stand up. You used to run a show at the Red Rock.
Yeah.
Which is now State Social House. But you started stand-up when?
Probably 2003.
Right.
In L.A.
In L.A.
I was working at an office in the L.A. Film School. So afterwards, I'd go take Groundling classes, then do whatever open mic would have me evening.
Where are you from?
Carlsbad, San Diego County.
I went to Carlsbad once with an ex-girlfriend. Thanks for bringing that up. but starting comedy in L.A., people don't realize is... I mean, it's a... an overwhelming ambition because you're just like, when you jump in, I think it's also a blessing and a curse because I don't think you know truly how competitive and crazy it is, at least for me. So I start, you know, doing the open mics and I'm just like, all right, well, there's a lot of them. And
yeah.
There are a lot of comics doing it. So like, as far as building your support system, that was pretty easy. But why did you even move from Carlsbad? Which sounds like a stupid question. But
yeah.
Who's trying to stay in Carlsbad?
I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
And then I went to the other school in Los Angeles. I know you're a Trojan.
Yeah.
And I went to undergrad as a Bruin.
You son of a bitch.
But Adam, and
that's been Matty Ballacher. You can follow him on Twitter. Fuck the Bruins.
But then later I went to USC.
Right.
So I made amends for you.
Thank you. For what? Undergrad or graduate school?
For an MBA.
Oh, shit.
Because that's what you need in stand-up comedy.
Yeah. Well, dude, even a theater degree, I remember, you know, jumping right into auditions and they're being like, yo, we're casting CSI Miami. You were in Vinegar Tom? Like, what does that even fucking mean? Like, you've done some Noel Coward? I don't think this is going to translate. When did your love for stand-up start? In college, as a kid?
Or? Yeah, you know, well before I started doing it semi-professionally.
Right.
I think Rodney Dangerfield was one of the first comics where I started watching and it really resonated. And I think part of it was because my dad was a fan. And
who was he into?
He was into Rodney. And actually Gallagher, so, you know, no one's perfect.
Hilarious, but also, as much as we want to make fun of Gallagher, like, the guy, I mean, shit, dude. There will never be another, because of the times, another guy that does that stuff and crushes.
No one's going to smash produce. No, I saw him in San Diego, and he was entertaining. You know, I was like 12 or something, but he put on a show.
Yeah.
And then... when I was a little bit older, my mom would tape Evening at the Improv. Do you remember that?
Yes. It was on HBO?
Or no, no. A&E or something. A&E, okay, yeah. And it was like, I think that's where I first saw Rob Schneider and Adam Sandler when they were just doing stand-up. And they didn't cuss, so my mom was cool with me watching it. So I'd come home and watch that for 12 minutes or so. And I think that's kind of when the, I don't want to say the seed or the love of comedy was planted. But I think I just always had... an inkling for it. And then in college, I took a quarter off and I started interning at Conan O'Brien.
Oh, shit.
And that was like, oh, you can like make a living doing this shit.
Yeah,
like,
oh, yeah.
There are these people. And then you realize, I mean, you know this. It's like, it's the hardest thing you can do, but you can do it. But that was the first experience I saw to like people who were funny and made money off of it.
And being like, on a set and seeing like the inner workings and... Did you ever get to chat with Conan and get some advice? Or
I don't know if I got advice, but yeah. I did get to chat with them. And it was funny because sometimes like it would be like 20 minutes before a show and I'd want to talk to him about anything. Yeah. And he'd kind of blow me off and be like, what an asshole.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, he has this multi-million dollar production on his back. I'm some pissant intern.
Yeah.
Then I remember going to a holiday party and he couldn't have been cooler.
That's
like,
awesome.
I mean, like I talk about someone who couldn't help him.
Yeah.
And he gave me the time of day and was like, chatted me up. So that was pretty sweet.
Did you want to be in comedy since you were a kid, or was it just kind of like, because I know for me it was, you know, I was like, oh, I'm a funny kid with my friends, and like, you know, and you start to get little nuggets of like, oh, maybe, and then you make other people that you don't know laugh, which is like a good you know, indication of maybe there's something there. But I didn't know that this was a profession again until
right.
you have to get some bigger experience. And even being down here in LA for college, I was like, how do you even get into, say, like, do I go to the club? Is it just, do I sign up? It's like, when did it become real for you? It's like, all right, this is something that I think I got the chops for.
Probably when I started doing the show at yeah. Red Rock around 2006. And it was twofold because I saw lots of great comedy. Like Sickler was a regular, Brian Scolaro, Greg Fitzsimmons. And like, it was eye-opening.
Scolaro's one of the best, dude.
Because I was like, you know, I can perform with them, but I'm not at their level.
Right.
And that was actually important because being one of the better ones at an open mic, you know, it's not worth nothing because you need to cut your teeth somewhere.
Yeah.
But that was like, oh, okay. I see these guys doing it and I want to be like them.
It is a great thing for a young comic to be on those shows. I remember the first show I was on that had Scolaro and Joe Rogan. It was a place called The Bank Heist in North Hollywood.
The Bank Heist.
Now it's the, not the tower. It's off of Lancashire. It's upstairs. Huh. Anyway, great room. My buddy Brett Riley ran it and I was on the show with those guys and I was like, this is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. So you get a little bit in your head of like, all right, I guess I'm as good as Joe Rogan now. Wow, this didn't take very long. And, but you need to get a little taste of like how good it can be so that it makes you work harder. And then to go back to the shows that you're consistently, you know, doing and hopefully be better there. And then it just is going to, you know, build from that. But when did your love for Greg Giraudo come into your life? So being out here, I'm sure you start to get introduced to more of the greats and just the people that are consistently working, right?
Yeah. With Giraudo, it was actually at Conan because he did a set and he was just some dude. You know, this was 2000,
wow.
I think. And you know, they have like 4.5 minutes of material, maybe five. And they had lots of comics, but there's something about
This is New York Conan or LA Conan?
New York Conan.
Okay, great.
And that was just like the first kind of appetizer to Giraudo. And I was just like, oh, he was good. Like, he was really good. But
yeah.
I didn't really think too much of it. And then
because he wasn't a household name.
No.
You know? He did the roast, but...
This was before. This was 2000. And then it was really Tough Crowd. Do you remember that show? Tough Crowd with Colin?
Yes. Come on, dude.
So that was... Because I was working at the LA Film School... and then I'd come home. I lived in Larrabee for like 10 years.
Yeah.
And I remember like try to do an open mic, whatever. But I always look forward to 11:30 on Comedy Central. I sometimes watch The Daily Show, but it was Tough Crowd that got me in my room. And religiously, I'd watch it Monday through Thursday. And then when I saw him, I was like, he's funny. He's smart. He's off the cuff. Like he had every element.
Yeah.
And he was so good. He almost made me sound so douchey, but like not want to do stand up.
Yeah.
Because it was like almost like watching Michael Jordan and be like, I want to play basketball too.
Yeah,
I was I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, that's such a dumb reason not to do something there's actually someone better than me.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
But he was so good. It was like he was doing something other than stand up. He was smart and he was quick and he was just so freaking entertaining.
And likable, right?
And like you said, he had this vulnerability and he didn't come off as like holier than thou, even though he was the smartest one in the room.
Dude, he could outwit you and outtalk you probably in any conversation.
Oh, yeah.
But he had a real soft sensibility to him that was like, he didn't want to talk down to you or over you. He just wanted to let you in on what was
going on in his brain. And he went to, his undergrad was Columbia.
Yeah.
And then he went to Harvard Law a year before Barack Obama went there. And he was on Tough Crowd with these comics. And there'd always be someone from California who'd kind of be snooty because I'm smart and like want you to know it. And he never used his education to sell his jokes. You know, it was just, his material was so good. You know, he didn't need any artifice, and that was just brilliant.
And it was That episode with Dennis Leary, right? Is that the one you're talking about?
That was one of them.
Yeah. I mean, that one is the famous one that gets tossed around where it's, you know, he goes toe-to-toe with, as Lenny Clark says, like it was the jester making fun of the king because yeah. Dennis Leary was, you know, heavily revered at that point. Oh,
he was the celebrity guest.
Yeah. And to see Greg just kind of, I mean, I should find the clip, but to see him kind of just like lay in on Dennis and outsmart him and then outwit him. And
yeah.
I think he said something to the effect of, he was like, you know, Greg made all these points and Dennis Leary was like, wow, I didn't know we had to take all these notes and come prepared. And he's like, yeah, well, that's what we do. Dennis, we're comedians. We write jokes and
a little comedy,
like,
right?
Yeah. A little comedy writing. Maybe if you did a little comedy writing yourself, your show would still be on the air.
And it was like bombs dropped.
Yeah, dude. After he was like, Greg, you're the guy that does the homework and then asks for more to get extra credit. And it's like, but even that, the way he delivered it didn't come off like, you know, aggressive. It was just,
and Adam, it wasn't planned.
Yeah.
And they did plan a lot of stuff. I mean, he was prepared and most of his stuff was pre-written, but he was working on a manicure joke because they were talking about North Korea. That was what was setting the stage. Right. And Colin Quinn said, like, should we do something? You know, should we take a military action? And Geraldo was starting a bit about, well, maybe there's other ways, like if American girls agree to get their nails done twice a week, North Korea will like not point nukes at us. And then, you know, it's a funny joke, yeah. But then Dennis Leary interrupted him. He's like, oh, there's a country that we hate that hates us that's got nuclear weapons pointing at us. You think there's a nonviolent way?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, like Russia, for example, that big Russian war. And it was just off the cuff. And he's like, oh.
And I would never think to have that be my retort. You know what I'm saying? Like,
and it was true, but it happened, what, a nanosecond?
Yeah.
Like after yeah. he was interrupted. It's like, that's something, if you had 4 weeks to write and research,
yeah.
then, you know, you could come also up
to
with
not
that.
Even be phased in that moment when Leary interrupts you to try to pull the rug out from under you. He just kind of stays in the pocket and is like, well, this is what I say to that. You
right.
know? And do you think that, obviously, his writing, he was so good at, I love that Geraldo had so many topical bits, but he also, where I learned and became encouraged to look at current event things, he was great at taking like news stories that didn't have a shelf life, but were so pertinent and relatable to everybody. Like the one about the married couple that the
we guy, all fight.
The guy jumped off the cruise ship. You know, it's like he was struck by lightning 7 times and he's like, God himself couldn't kill this guy. So he's like, oh, calling the experts. But it's like a joke like that, that is a great, you know, look into marriage and relationships. And again, didn't have a shelf life, but was this like true story. And that's when I was like, oh man, you got to scour the news. And because I guess I got conditioned to be like, oh, if you're writing something that you saw in the paper or online, it's got to be, you know, something right now.
Yeah.
But it's like, nah, dude, there's so much shit out there that you can pull from.
That's a good point. Like his topical material was pretty evergreen. Like you can watch stuff he was doing about news bits in 2008 and it's funny now. And as you said, most of that stuff doesn't have a shelf life.
Yeah. So you see him at Conan and then, and you're like, all right, this guy's great. Then Tough Crowd.
Yeah. When I saw him at Conan, I was like, oh, this guy's really good. Then Tough Crowd, I was like, he's the Michael Jordan.
You start just telling everybody about him and you're like, you yourself get more invested and like, I got to go make sure I'm going to see him wherever he is.
Oh, for sure. And this was the time of, I mean, it was pre-Twitter. And so comedians had websites. And his website was pretty weak. It just had the occasional tour date.
Wow.
And I knew he went to Harvard and I knew there was like some cool stuff about him, but he never publicized it. And now that's so refreshing, like a comedian who doesn't tell you everything.
I know, dude. I still don't think, I don't know what, I think he'd be very Bill Burr about his social media and his, even his Instagram. You know, like he'd be posting stuff here and there. I bet his stories would be good, you know, funny, but I also, it'd be like Burr. It'd be like he doesn't really know what he's doing. He doesn't really want to do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, it's like, I'm a comic. I'm not a social media activist or influencer.
Where did you see him next that made you truly, like, did you start to, he became your favorite comic, yeah?
Yeah. It was at the Cellar, because my brother lived in New York, and so I'd visit sometimes, and I think whenever I was in town, I'd go to the Comedy Cellar, and he was a regular there.
Right.
And that was cool, because it was just a club. And I'd see him riff off the crowd and I'd see him do his planned material and it was brilliant. And then I think 2007, maybe six, it was The Insomniac Yeah. I'm using tour in air quotes, yes. but it was David Tell, and it was here in
Dane
Hollywood.
Cook, yeah.
Yeah. And I actually, it's funny. I ended up, my brother was out of town, so I ended up taking his wife because we were going to go. And,
yeah.
And she's a big comedy fan, yeah. super cool. And I was like, you got to see Greg. And she knew I was kind of obsessed with him.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, she's like, you're right. Like, he was.
Yeah.
He was the best.
Doesn't that feel good too when you get to introduce somebody to a new comic that you're like, this guy should be a household name.
Yeah.
I can't believe you don't know, but I'm excited for you to to get to know about him. And so what about that show really stuck out?
Well, maybe because he was sober, but
okay.
he just seemed like in a good place mentally.
Did you know that he had addiction problems? When did you start to really dive into who he was, you know?
Well, when I started writing the book, that was 2000, or researching the book, it was 2015.
Oh, no
so way. But well before then, I would follow him, and he'd always reference that he gave up drinking, and then at roast, people would make fun of his alcoholism. So I knew there was something there, and then I think it was a Conan interview around 95.
Right.
I'm sorry, it was around 2005. He mentioned that he was sober, but he wasn't that, like, the type, and this sounds so ignorant, who you would think would be an addict.
Mm.
You know, he didn't look like it.
Yeah.
He looked like a lawyer. He looked like an accountant. He was just some dude. And it shows that those demons, I mean, they can creep in any of us, and they're nasty.
It was a pretty public thing that at least I found out after he passed, that he did have these battles with addictions. And, you know, everyone has their own opinion about how much you should step in, what's appropriate to say or do. It's not my business. It should be my business. He's a good friend of mine. Like, he's an adult though too, so who am I to babysit? But in doing all your research for the book, A Comedian Story, by the way,
yeah,
Greg Giraldo, A Comedian Story.
Thank you.
At what point, how much of the book did you make about that? Because I feel like, you know, there's so many great things to celebrate about who Greg was and what he did and how great of a comedian and from what I gained and what I've had in my minimal experience with him, how great of a person he was, and to everybody, right? And but those addictive, demonizing traits, like, he just couldn't shake. And in doing your research, and what do you think attributed to that?
It was a mental issue. Like, he didn't have diagnosed depression, but I'm sure if he went to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, he would have been diagnosed as depressive. And he had accounts from when he was in college, just thinking he wasn't good enough and that he was an outsider. And so he mentions in a few interviews, one was very telling in Opie and Anthony, that he was just never comfortable in his own skin. And so when he would have have some booze and a few shots, then he felt normal. And so he was trying to calm, like, the noise in his head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was with him pretty much his whole adulthood. So I don't think it was this thing like, oh, he's a stand-up comedian, or he's upset that he's not more famous than he is, and so he's going to turn to alcohol and drugs. It's like, no, he had some mental issues, and he was self-medicating, and he was medicating in a way that was very destructive.
Right. Did he have people, enablers? You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
Like, also, it seems like at comedy clubs you go to, people are coming at you being like, hey, man, I want to do drugs with you. I want to do this. It's the way they do with Doug Benson with pot. You know,
sure.
It's like, I know that Greg was getting that probably with coke and other things. And if it's at that accessible, why are you saying no to it, right?
You're the celebrity in every town you go to.
And he had I know after a while, again, this is just hearsay, but, like, yeah, doing the road, having his family. He was 44, right, when he passed? And so just getting into his 40s and being at a place to where you're like, God, I'm doing the same fucking club
right.
again. And probably for good I'm money, I want to assume.
Oh,
but,
sure, yeah.
But, you know, he didn't. I mean, you tell me. I mean, tons of pilots that didn't end up going, right? He had a ton of chances, and it seemed like
people were always
trying to make something with him in mind.
Exactly. And John Stewart had a good point about that. He said they always wanted to make something with him in mind because he was that good. Like, if he sucked, you wouldn't be asking him to come back. And he began comedy, you know, around 93, and when he was a lawyer. And then by 95, he was filming a pilot for ABC.
That's crazy.
So he had this crazy ascent early on.
Was he that good early on?
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't as good as he became.
Did
so
you get access to like tapes and stuff? Yeah. Like, and you spoke to his family and
I spoke to his family members.
Wow.
I spoke to his longest tenured wife, who was awesome.
Yeah.
But you know, to get back to your point, it's like he was very good, and then he needed to get his footing as a comic.
Sure.
And then so he has his first sitcom the same year. Was it News Radio came out?
Yeah.
Like he and Joe Rogan would shoot the shit at break. And how long was News Radio on the air?
Yeah.
And Greg's ended after 4 episodes. And then that was unfortunately the only one that actually aired, the only sitcom. But every year he had holding deals. So he was making 6 figures a year without even doing anything, just because people wanted to have access to his talents.
Fuck.
Yeah, so I mean, on one hand, people say, "Oh, he was critical of himself and his success, like, oh, he was a loser, or you know, he never really made it." And maybe, I mean, yeah, he's not Zach Galifianakis, but like, you know, how many people can really make that good of a living doing something that's super fun?
So his pilot gets canceled, and then he just jumps fully into stand up.
He moved back to New York. In fact, he was worried that. We talked to some actors on the show, and during the taping, he would play to the audience. So he was worried that being a quote unquote actor would hurt his stand up.
Oh, wow.
So when he moved back to New York in around 96, he went, you know, head first into stand up.
When did it kind of turn for him? When did people around him, because he came up with the Louis, the Burrs, right? Yeah. Wasn't he kind of in that?
John Stewart.
Yeah. When did it start to take a turn where people were like, this fucking Greg Giraldo guy is pretty funny?
Probably 95 when he got the deal, okay. The sitcom deal.
So still just 2 years in.
But then, you know, lots of ups and downs. And I mean, we're talking about him now, but I did a show last night in Orange County, and obviously there are comedy fans there. And afterwards I was kind of promoting the book, and I'd say half the crowd didn't know who he was. And wow. And these weren't all millennials. You know, I'd say the average age was 35 plus.
Yeah, such a fucking bummer.
And so it shows like even... at his peak, there was a lot of people who were quote unquote comedy fans or in the industry who didn't really know much about him.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
It's a great question. I think there are a few facets. One, he wasn't a movie star.
Yeah.
He wasn't on a sitcom regularly. And I think...
as great as he was in the roast, that's not... And those do get a lot of accolades and exposure, but...
When you saw him, he wasn't a roast comic. Uh-uh. I mean, he was a roast comic in that he would roast, but it wasn't like Lisa Lampanelli or Jeff Ross, where when you watch him at the improv, you're I could see them roasting, you know?
Yeah.
They're putting people down.
I
could see him tearing apart David Hasselhoff.
Yeah.
I'm saying, but no, Greg was just a very cerebral, smart comic who happened to be a good roaster, but he also had a little like in, you know, I think it used to be cool to kind of shit on Dane Cook, but Dane Cook did a lot of really smart things Greg didn't. And so he wasn't a good marketer. He didn't hire a high priced publicist. He didn't put his efforts into getting his name out as much as he could have.
Did he just think that he would rest on, he was like, my talent should be able to carry me through, or he didn't care, or he just...
I think he didn't care. I mean, he loved performing, and he was, for smart as he was, ridiculously unorganized.
Yeah.
So he kind of lived life from one day to the next in that, I want to tell jokes at this club. I want to go read the newspaper, create some new bits, try them out at this club. He wasn't like someone who'd have a team. And I think he would have benefited from this.
He had a team though, right? I mean,
well, yeah, no, you're right. Like, and he had good managers and he had good people around him, but in terms of like a team that's like, what's your 5-year plan?
Yeah.
You know, what's your 3-year plan? Do you want to do movies? Do you want to do more TV shows?
Right. Did his addiction and just zest for, you know, having some fun post show probably get in the way of that too?
100%. I mean, it's funny, like right after I finished saying, I was like, and there was that whole addiction thing. So it's a little bit like,
yeah, dude,
if you're in the hospital and you're like, hey, why aren't you worried about your 401k right now? Have you diversified your portfolio? It's like, dude, I might die.
Yeah. How much did his family know about that part of what he was going through?
More than most. Marianne, his wife, was one of the first people we interviewed. And when they met in, I guess, 96, and they were dating, and she worked at Caroline's, she saw early on that like his hands would shake. you know, like getting like withdrawal shakes. And I guess her father was an alcoholic.
Wow.
And so that was early. You know, I mean, that was really kind of before he, I mean, it's post sitcom, but really before he broke is like this big national headliner. And he did a really good job hiding it from other people, but she saw right through, you know, his bullshit. And
had no problem saying something to him about
it. Yeah. Well, and as you'll read in Greg Giraldo, comedian's story, you know, she mentioned that she probably enabled him, but she also may have not known the extent.
Right.
Because it's like, we all know people who can outdrink anyone and then they're fine, but it only takes one weekend in New Jersey and then you don't wake up from it.
Yeah.
But so with his family, that was, you know, unfortunately they saw the brunt of it. Not so much his kids, although there was,
he hid it from his kids. Oh,
to an extent. And, yeah. And he even talked about this, like, you know, when you're on the road, you can kind of be the rock star party animal for a while.
Yeah.
And then it creeps into your life.
Yeah.
Then you have to decide, okay, when can I get drunk?
Around my kids' schedule.
Yeah. So when they come home, I'm not going to, you know, be obvious. And then.
Because he was a good dad. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly imperfect, like all of us fathers. Yeah. But that was a common through line. Like everyone who I interviewed, they're like, he loved his kids.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of issues with himself, but when he was happiest, it involved his children.
Man.
And we were talking earlier about like the family influence, and it was his wife though, who had the guts in 2008 to say, you know, you need your issues are ruining our family. So she kicked him out of the house. I mean, they were going, and that kind of started their separation, but you know, he was the love of her life. He was the father of her children. You know, she definitely loved him.
Yeah.
But she's like, imagine you're with someone and like you see them deteriorating and you're like, if, you know, sometimes you just have to be on their own.
To get your shit together.
To get your shit together. Exactly.
Damn. That's a tough move too, man. Just to have that much love for somebody but be like, I can't babysit you. I can't be the one to make these changes. You
right.
gotta do it. But also like just to kick them out and then you know, cut ties, but also I'm sure it's all what you're thinking about. Is
right.
How are they doing?
And they didn't cut ties in that there was no communications, okay. But they cut ties in that you're not sleeping under my roof.
Right.
And it was, I mean, there's some instances where there were like parent teacher conferences that he didn't show up. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like the addiction and the issues surrounding that, they crept into the home life.
Man, why do you think, you know, he just couldn't get a true grasp on, you know, I guess you said too that there may be a chemical imbalance or, you know, I heard some people say he was too smart for his own good. Like, did you talk to other comedians about Greg for the book?
Oh,
like,
yeah. Yeah. We interviewed about 70 people.
Holy shit.
And I think.
Was it easy to get access? I mean, once you.
Some.
Yeah.
Some weren't. You know, a lot of comedians were really forthright. They're like, yeah. And they're so willing to like do publicity. But then when it's like those that were close to him, it was a little tougher because that was their friend. And who am I?
Like, yeah, you know, but I mean,
I'm like some nobody in the West Coast who wants to ask about their buddy who died.
For sure. But also, you know, I think, you know, celebrating and you tell me, but in the book, I'm sure it's painting the picture of the story and wanting to give an honest look into who he was. Right. But also I'm sure there's a lot of celebrating his life and how great he was. Right.
Yeah.
So if doing that, I would, you know, jump at the chance if I was close to them to be like, oh fuck, I want people to know. I want as many outlets for people to know and get a better understanding of how great he was.
Well, I agree. Thank you for saying that.
What who'd you get to talk to that really
was several special? Jim Gaffigan.
Nice.
Colin Quinn, he wrote the foreword.
Oh great.
Robert Kelly, Jessica Kersan, Judy Gold, Noam Dorman, who's the owner of the comedy cellar.
Jesse Joyce is
Jesse
owner.
Joyce. Yeah, we had a long interview with him.
Yeah,
Nick DiPaolo, Jim Norton,
Jeff Ross. Yeah,
actually, Jeff Ross. It's funny. He's been so helpful post book.
Yeah,
and I met with him a couple times, but we never actually recorded the interview.
Yeah,
so he was kind of tangentially a part of it, but never actually like an on the record interview. Yeah.
What was the thing that you would find most consistent from everybody? Like, what was the Was there a
his willingness to help those who couldn't necessarily help him? I mean, that was what, like, Gaffigan had a good point. He said he would never be friends with someone because it helped their career or because it helped his career. And Jesse Joyce mentioned that when they started writing the roast together, Greg would make it a point afterwards to say, you know, Jesse wrote that, you know, that one joke about Flavor Flav. That wasn't me.
Wow. It's real
and,
selfless.
Huh? And he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
And I think DePaulo had similar thing. Like he was really willing to help people. And there's a guy, Patrick Melton. I don't know if he's a friend of mine here. And he opened for Greg in Florida a while back. And a similar thing, like, you know, most headliners, they don't have to talk to the feature act.
Yeah.
And he took them out to lunch and they actually like talk shop. They, Greg and Pat would like work on punchlines together. That's awesome. And he would give this like salient advice. And so in many ways, he was a very willing mentor and a mentor to people who, you know, it wasn't like Jeff Katzenberger, you know, like, yeah, like someone who's like, all right, I'm going to write a 7-figure check for you right now.
It's a really cool thing when people want to go out of their way to give time and not expect anything in return, right, especially at Greg's level. Like, yeah, like he's, you know, unfortunately, and also understandably in this business, people, you know, time is money and people that are, whose time is valuable, like, yeah, they are going to be a little more tight with how they, you know, send it out. But that makes really cool, I don't know, for him to be that engaging with people that, again, like you said, aren't really going to give him an immediate result or something that he can take. But maybe that's, I think that's why he was such a relatable person on stage, is that he was a, you know, I think a comics comic, but also a people's comic, where it's right, like he definitely could, I don't think there was, he had one specific audience, right?
No, and in fact, I'm glad you brought that up, because people ask, like, what makes someone a good comedian? You know, it's like, you can't really quantify it.
Yeah.
And I had to think about that, because most of the people who came to his shows were there because they were going to the improv. And so they weren't necessarily there to see Greg Giraldo.
Right.
And so he could take these people from very like disparate backgrounds and entertain all of them. And he would have jokes that would come off as liberal, that would come off as conservative, that would come off as atheist, that would come off as religious. Yeah. I mean, like, he really hit all sides, and then like everyone could laugh at it. And so like he could take a room full of strangers and give them like an awesome evening of entertainment. Mm. And I think that's something not even just comedians, like very few performers can do.
Yeah. It's one of the things, one of the many things I think that I have picked up from him again, which is, and it's cool to recognize that once you get, you know, I'm 12 years in now, but like to see the things and the people you love that you have somehow embodied and made your own, but like things like, you know, not actively isolating the crowd, which mm-hmm. is something that I have always tried to do innately, but
no, you're very good at that. Like, oh, thanks. I mean, you're good, period, but that's one thing. And especially like, I think it's easy for comedians to get soapboxy.
Yeah.
Especially here where like a lot of people kind of think the same.
And at the end of the day, it's like, I want to be entertaining. I want to be funny. I definitely want to push and challenge myself, and I want to have thought provoking material, but I want to be funny at the end of it. And I don't want to, I'm not up there to try to make a change or to push some agenda.
An activist on stage. You can just let people enjoy their evening.
But I think there is, but the deeper you get into this and the more of a, you know, just an active person you get in mind and body and just being on this planet, you definitely have thoughts that you are like, well, I have this great outlet and I do have these thoughts that I am challenging my way mm-hmm. to make into a bit. And you do want to share those and challenge yourself to be like, wow, can I, again, with the topical stuff, like taking something that that you think it might be off topic and challenging yourself to find the funny in it and then make it relatable to strangers. And I think he was just so fucking good at it. And amongst many things, what did people say that you talked to, comedians, family, Jesse, like that they said were their favorite parts about Greg?
Probably, like, aside from his willingness to help, just his love of his kids,
yeah,
and how genuine he was. Like, he didn't put on a front. Like, he'd be the same to you as he would be, more or less, you know, to David Letterman.
Yeah,
like it wasn't this like facade. Like, okay, I'm gonna chummy up with the showbiz types, right. And then because another, like, he was actually very like sensitive.
In what way?
In two ways. One, he was vulnerable to criticism, which we all are to some extent, but he was, I think, a little more, and it's funny because he was this roast comic. And second, and this came up, and it was hard for me to define. He seemed to like have a very big problem with injustice, and I think more broadly that just means like underdogs. Like this is an example. We didn't put it in the book, but Jesse would say that like after shows, Greg always liked it when there's kind of like a nerdy kid who maybe was a little shy, and like he would take a picture with him or do something to kind of like prop up that kid.
Yeah.
Because he was like, you know, kind of got the sense like he wasn't the all-American jock in high school or something
like
that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, but Greg, was he cool in school, and was he like, did he have a lot of friends? Was he, because he seemed like a real social type, and
he was a little bit of a brawler and amongst his Ivy League frat boys at Columbia. So he went to Regis High School.
Oh yeah.
I've
heard of it. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, the fact that we're in California and you've heard of a high school in New York shows like how big of a deal it is. It's sort of like the Harvard of high schools. And so he was a kind of a class clown in Regis. And then he went to Columbia, which is like 3 miles away, and he joined a frat. In fact, that was what he was most into as an undergrad. And he was a guitar player who was in a band, but he kind of had a little bit of this like ruffian nature. Yeah. And he was one of the few guys in his frat who could throw a punch. And so he wasn't this total hard ass, but he'd get in fights. And in fact, even, we discussed it in Greg Giraldo, a comedian story, when he was at Harvard Law, you know, he went out with some of his buddies there who were all like, you know, nerdy law school types. Yeah, yeah. And he got in a fight with some guy there who ended up cold cocking him and he passed out on the sidewalk. So he was a cool guy. He was funny, but he wasn't afraid to throw a punch.
Right. Man. Yeah, there's so much to a guy like this that you feel like you know from watching him on stage. And I think comedians in general are good at like projecting one version of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the version, and especially with social media, which he may or may not have been a part of, showing like, this is who I am. This is what I want you to see, right?
Right.
And I think he did a good job of that, again, with hiding really what was going on. Did any of these comics that you talked to, do you talk to Attell at all?
No. We exchanged emails, and then he ended up not wanting to do it. But
I'm sure, I mean, they seem pretty tight, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Greg was very, insecure is the right word, but he thought Dave Attell was a genius. And I'm not arguing with that. But so much so that, like, Greg wasn't in his league. And, you know, as we see from your DVD here, Adam.
Yeah.
Like Dave Attell said, Greg is a great comic and a master joke writer. Plus, he is one of the few guys who can drink me under the table. Like, obviously, Greg deserved to be in his league.
Yeah.
You know, but like to think you're not. I mean, that shows like when something's going on in your head, logic doesn't always come into play.
What, did people recite favorite bits, or did they tell you what they loved about him on stage, or what they were jealous of, or what they, cause he did have an effortless way of even just being on stage. Like
that's a good, I mean, a lot of people were kind of jealous of, and Colin Quinn mentioned this, of just how prolific he was. Like, Colin and some of the other people would be at the Comedy Cellar, like roughly hashing out ideas about whatever news event, you know, whatever Christina Aguilera said that week or something.
Right.
And then Greg would go on stage and have 10 minutes on it, you know, and like he could just turn it around.
Yeah.
And that's not to say it was all like worthy of his special, but to just have that. And so Colin said that, like it put everyone on edge, you know, like in a way we admire that. You're like, but there's also, Adam, there's jealousy in comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. You think?
And so when you see someone doing that all the time, you might be like, yeah, what's his deal? Why doesn't he just fine tune what he's already done?
Isn't that funny? Instead of coming up with new shit every night, right?
Yeah. But I know Robert Kelly really loved the Healy Wheels bit when he was talking about, it was on Midlife Vices.
Oh,
the fat kids.
Yeah.
Are in roller skates.
Yeah, dude. Just putting, yeah, fat kids on wheels. Yeah, dude, that's so good. Was there one topic that, or was there something that you gathered that he liked to do? Because his crowd work, he was also, I don't think, got enough credit for. Like, and in, when I hosted for him at the Irvine Improv that weekend, and, you know, I even went up on stage and I had this short-sleeved checkered shirt and a backwards hat and a clean-shaven baby face. And it was, give it up for Adam, everybody. Dressed like a fucking nine-year-old, came straight from Picture Day in 1994. He goes, God damn, thanks for dressing up, Adam. You know, whatever. Which was just so flattering, you know. And then he dealt with so much stuff during the show. And he also would do this thing that, again, I have just picked up on, I'm sure subconsciously, in watching him, which he did one night in the Irvine Improv, where the smallest, and he would call attention to it, the smallest little peep, he would somehow sometimes stop a full bit and the momentum that he was having to address like a, like some little something. He'd just stop himself and then go into it and make a funny bit out of that and then try to get back into the bit. But he was like, he would even say, he's like, it's a blessing and a curse that I can't not address every little peep. He's like, that's on me. He's like, but fucking also, what are you talking about? Your Halloween costume? You're fucking 48 years old. You're really dressing up for Halloween. You fucking, you know, whatever it was. And I, in my crowd work too, sometimes I have to remind myself to like, hey, you get to acknowledge this moment or not, or you can keep moving.
And, it's your choice.
And not cut your own toes off. But I think especially in the special, Midlife Vices, like, you know, they left in that crowd work moment with the guy with the Rastafarian hair, which
when he fell asleep in the second row.
Did anybody talk to that point of just how, again, like locked in he always was, like not only with his material, but he just seemed like connected and present always.
Yeah. In fact, I'm glad you brought up the crowd work element, because he was brilliant, but he also called it a crutch. Like he kind of, he could have done 20 minutes of crowd work every show, but he didn't want to do it too much. But there was one instance where it was, I think, Stand Up New York. And there was this lady who was just like being freaking annoying to like every comic that was up there, you know, stepping on her punchlines. And when he went up, he started talking about how we're all obsessed with personal freedoms and like we think we can just say whatever we want. And this woman was totally in agreement with him. And then he flipped it. He's like, you're doing it right now. You're violating everything I'm saying. Yeah. And then she was like, you're right. And then apparently like afterwards, like she loved it, you know, but it showed like even the heckler and it's not totally out of this world to think, oh, a heckler will actually like the comedian. Right. But I mean, he really like flipped the switch on her and put her down, but he put her down in a way that was like artistic and still kind of sensitive,
right,
where it wasn't so unnerving that she could still enjoy his stand-up.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, it's one of those...
He wasn't just like, fuck you, cunt.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is so easy to do. Drop a C-bomb to get out of anything.
Yeah. So what was your interactions with them? I mean, cause you got to work with them and
just working with them and, you know, and I was blown away at just, again, how I put them up on this pedestal and, you know, this Midlife Vices had just come out. I thought Good Day to Cross a River was, you know, exceptional.
That was super funny.
But also I feel, you know, real bummed on many levels that again, I feel like we have a handful of voices, comedically that are the voices of like that we need, you know, and his commentary, like even you talking about just being a fighter for injustice. And I think, you know, what he would be able to speak on like socially right now would be invaluable for, you know, the way to take like the what like John Oliver does. I put Greg in that same boat where he'd be able, maybe he'd be a correspondent of that. Maybe he would have his own
comparison.
Maybe he would have that type of show finally.
Like, I mean, Trevor Noah's great, but imagine Geraldo hosting the Daily Show. Oh, man,
yeah.
I'm sure Jon Stewart would have given his blessing.
Fuck yeah, man. But he was so kind. And I'm hosting for him. And so Jesse was real cool and who was featuring for him and became his writing partner. And he, you know, I would even ask Jesse first, like, is he cool? Like, can I go up? And he's like, yeah, he's the best. Like, sit down, whatever. So, because, you know, I would always be, which I think you should in those early stages, like, read the room and back up and don't just sit down and start. Also, don't be shy. I definitely went up to introduce and say I'm hosting, but didn't fan out and didn't, and just like, what do you want me to say? And then and then kind of picked and choose, didn't sit with them unless he invited me over, which he did.
So you can read the room yourself.
Yeah, exactly. I would kind of float around, but then he told me I was funny after, and he even gave me a few punches, punch ups on a few jokes. And then we all just, you know, shot the shit at pre and post show every time. And it was, you know, man, I wish I had like somehow recorded the conversations on my phone, which I've done before, with people when I'm just like, I can't believe I'm here. But, I was just really taken aback by how, like you said, just normal he was for being, again, when you put somebody up on that pedestal and they say, don't meet your heroes. But I was just like, and you need those interactions, man. When you're getting going, you need somebody like that to, I mean, fuck, this was 2009 probably. Yeah. And so I'm 2 years in, you know, and,
that's not a bad gig for 2 years in.
I could do 10 minutes, you know, and get the crowd fired up is what that was. But I also berated the gal that I knew that was hey. Booking those in weekends to be like, yeah,
can't be shy.
You gotta let me do this weekend, you know? And, it's rare to have somebody that you, it's like with bands, you know, and like when people are, you know, make fun of people for being so into one band. I'm like, dude, there's so much bullshit out there. And there's also now just so many performers and so many genres and everything that like to have something you get really fixated and fired up about on many levels. And I felt really, it just like made me feel really good that I had this person that I was like, man, I can always expect new stuff from. I couldn't wait to, when he would pop up on a TV show or an article or something that he had written, or he was in town from New York and LA doing the Comedy Juice shows or whatever he was doing, I had a chance to just, you know, like I told you, I was going to fly up to Seattle just to see him perform. And you know, I had known him, and Jesse would be with him, so I know I would probably get to hang out in the green room and just be around him, you know? And there's, again, like you said, there's so much jealousy and a competitiveness in this world that to have people like that you just are enamored by and have, you know, a little bit of support from goes a long way. What do you think people are going to love about this book? What did you love about writing this book that you, because you were a fan.
Oh, yeah.
And what even like compelled you to do this? Like, did you just feel bad that not enough people knew who he was?
That was a big part of it. My wife was pregnant with our second, and I had to get like a real job for a while, which, you know, I don't recommend. And
what was that job?
Financial advisory.
Wow. You seem like you'd be good at that.
Thanks.
Yeah. But not fun.
No.
Yeah.
I hated it.
I'm
kind of one of those people, like once I'm involved with something, I'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, but like every day I was like, I don't want to be doing this in a year. Kind of thing.
Fuck yeah.
So, but also I was like, this is my second child. And I was like, I can't just worry about me, you know? So it was like one of those like heart to heart, you know, internal, yeah. like, oh, you know, I want to be telling dick jokes, but you know, I'm not really pulling in the big dough here bar shows. So I was at this desk job. And then I was on break and I went on Amazon and I did the search for Greg Giraldo book and nothing came up and I was kind of pissed. And I was like, why not? Like,
to me, I would always search things and find like the special that Comedy Central did and then appearances, a few, like, I'm sure you scour the web too for interviews. And there's a lot of some great ones of him just to camera and a few like young comics that, again, like you said, he was great with giving time to people that weren't going to maybe help, but he did a lot of like smaller interviews in towns for weekends.
And he would treat them like they were Howard Stern.
Yeah.
And so I was like upset that no one had written a book about him, and I really wanted to read it because I was like, you know, I'm at this job, I'm not gonna be doing as much stand up. And then it in a way kind of saved me because it was like this light bulb moment. I was like, oh, maybe this will be my new project. And I mean, I was one of the editors in chiefs of my high school paper, so that in my head was like enough, you know, background to be an author, which wasn't.
Yeah.
but it was just kind of the being stupid and naive. But what I did have was connections in comedy. And so I was like, well, I know this person, I know Jesse a little bit. And, you know, before I was like, I can tomorrow interview 10 people that knew him. And then a lot of it was selfishly, I just wanted to know more about him.
Yeah.
But it snowballed. So I just got this idea. And then about maybe 20 interviews in, I was like, I need some money. you know, because like I couldn't just transcribe all of them, mm-hmm. all the interviews myself, and like I knew there'd be other costs, but I didn't even know what those costs were.
Yeah.
And then I launched a Kickstarter campaign about 6 months after I had the initial idea, and that was important because one of the backers was Wayne Jones, who's the co-author on the book, and he's an academic librarian in Canada. And I was like, oh, this is perfect because he was a big comedy fan,
yeah.
but also knew all the documentation and all right. like the real work that goes into writing a book. And so we teamed up. And then after that, we would then kind of split up and do, you know, separate interviews. And then it took way longer than I thought. But with each interview, it was like, oh, okay, well, now I got to interview this person who saw him on Letterman. And then I got to go back to that waitress at the Comedy Cellar. And oh, I want to talk to his wife or his girlfriend or whatever. Yeah. And it just like kept building and building and building. And then it gets to this point where like, well, I don't want it to suck. And then I got some Kickstarter backer that like, when the fuck's the book coming out? You said it would be ready like a year ago. And whoa. I was like, sorry. But it was actually important, Adam, to have that kind of public disclosure.
Yeah.
Like, I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
Because without that, it would have been so easy to just be like, fuck it. This is tiring. This is exhausting.
I'm sure you had those moments, right?
Oh my God.
It's a big undertaking, dude. I don't even know where you get that sort of zest to just go, I'm going to do this. And then, but once you, kind of announce it and it's out there, you feel pressure to finish.
Yeah. It was like social embarrassment.
Sure.
Kind of like I didn't want to, you know, piss off the 73 people that bad, you know, and like in hindsight, you're kind of like, yeah, whatever. But it was actually like therapeutic too, because then I, you know, that job wasn't for me and we parted ways.
Yeah.
And then I was like, what am I going to do with my life? Luckily I have a good wife, but like I wasn't like at a happy place mentally. Cause I was like, how am I going to make money? But I had this book. And so like, it gave me something to do. It gave me a purpose.
Yeah, dude.
But it did. And then it was like, I was so deep into it. I was like, I'm going to finish this. And it took from, you know, that time I did the Amazon search to when it was released was about 5 years, which in my head, I thought it would take two, but I had no real basis for that. I just, two sounds like a decent number.
Yeah.
But you know, maybe someone else would have done it in shorter, whatever, but I'm actually proud of it. You know, it's like it's one of those things, like now that it took so long and it's out there, I was like, okay, there's something that like when I pass on, like there'll be something to
It's cool. It's cool that you've like Greg did, like just chose to kind of put yourself on hold, but put all of yourself into something that really, dude, I feel so fortunate to have had an interaction with him, but to have gotten to see him so many times live and live in the time when he was, giving us a lot. And, it's to even like try to write a book and to have it be about something that I think the way you approached it too, with trying to take something that people didn't necessarily have a giant, fandom of, like, mm-hmm. This book is, I mean, there's going to be, I'm sure, other, I mean, hopefully made a movie at some point, maybe even from your book.
I think Adam Race should star in, like, seriously, dude, you have the look, your voice is similar.
I would do that in a fucking heartbeat.
Hollywood, you listening?
I know, dude, they should be. I mean, yeah, dude, I would have, I know you just said you got the audiobook guy on lockdown, but if there's anything relating to Greg moving forward that you want me to be a part of, I definitely would do.
Well, I mean, we're in talks about like a documentary. We'll see what happens.
Whoa.
But
you should, man, there's more. I mean,
if there's like a live action, like if the stars can align where there could be a movie about him or a show, I'd love you to,
it's a great, actually, that would be a fucking killer Sundance type movie. You know what I'm saying? Where it's like,
maybe we'll get Adam Carolla's group to do it. Or
fuck yeah, they were close, right?
They were cool.
They're in the same world.
Yeah, they're in the same world. Share a lot of same sensibilities.
Fuck yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of Greg that I think the bigger scale of the world would have, and that's also like, man, what a cool thing. Like he never was able to crack that movie thing, so it's like, what an extra special way to pay tribute by like. And his life too, man, it's like there's a lot to learn from that and there's a lot of great themes and inspiring, yet like, but the ups and downs, it's like, shit, man, you even look at like Jamie Foxx doing Ray Charles and it's like, that story, like, yeah, man, like somewhat similar with like this raw talent, the addictive struggles, family. I mean, like Greg's, it's not like a story of just like, I mean, I don't know, man. I just even see that opening scene of him like leaving Harvard Law or whatever it is. There's a way to Hollywood it up and there's a way to keep it raw and keep it very like Little Miss Sunshine indie film, which I feel like is the route. But we should talk about that for sure.
We'll do it.
Fuck yeah. All right. Greg Giraudo, a comedian story. Available everywhere. Is there one spot you want people to go?
Amazon. Yeah. It's the best place.
It is, right?
I get the YouTube most cut. So, yeah.
You get the most cut from that? Okay,
and,
good.
And on social, we're at Greg Giraudo Book.
Great.
So we have updates. We're doing book signings. So check it out. And this is a passion project. So please tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
Maddie, tell your acquaintances.
Go get this book. If you love comedy, it's... you know, there's really not a better thing for you to consume. And we don't want Maddie to go back to financial advising.
No.
Because God knows he wasn't good at it. you're the best, dude. Thanks.
Thank you, Adam.
Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessime Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.
Meh, what's up, dog? This is your pal Bugs Bunny. Say, I got a question for you. Do you know who has the head of Elmer Fudd and the body of Foghorn Leghorn? Why, that's Adam Ray and Brad Williams. Ain't I a stinker?